Wonderful, majestic world around us. It's time for Dear Science. Thanks to MOTAT, the museum inspiring the innovators of tomorrow.
Hello, how are we doing?
Oh, we're doing pretty well, I think, Casper. We've got a big announcement to make.
Yes,
drum roll, please.
Do we make it now or do we make it next week? That's the question.
I think maybe we'll save it for next week and we can increase the tension.
Okay, we'll save it.
So everyone get excited for next week.
There is an announcement coming.
Big announcement coming next week. Tune in. Anyway, right, so this week on Dear Science, we're going to talk Tasmanian tigers. And somebody wants to bring them back. And, not quite sure how I feel about this one. So, the Tasmanian tiger, for those of you who don't know, is sadly extinct. And the last remaining Tasmanian tiger died in captivity in 1936. And apparently, in order for something to be classed as extinct, it's got to be 50 years since its last sighting. So in the 80s, it was classified as being extinct. And one of the reasons that it was that it became extinct was the fact that the government was offering a bounty for shooting these things because they were busy sort of attacking the cattle and the sheep and stuff like that. So we can't have that. And sadly, they were pretty much hunted to extinction. So for those of you who don't know, it's sort of a wolf-sized marsupial. Okay, so obviously, you know, very unusual being a marsupial and all that entails. And it was native to not only Tasmania, but also the Australian mainland and also New Guinea as well. So in all of those areas, it became extinct, which is pretty sad. So what are we going to do about this? Or what is a firm from the States going to do about this? Now, this firm is called Colossal, and they are a genetic engineering and, quote, de-extinction, unquote, company.
Strange title.
Yeah, I don't like that word, de-extinction. I don't know, but what else would you call it? Trying to bring something back from extinction?
Well, I'm concerned. Are they looking to make a colossal variant or just regular size?
Well,
maybe a resurrection? The resurrecting company.
Indeed. Well, who knows where it could go? But so last year they announced plans to bring back the woolly mammoth. And who wouldn't want a woolly mammoth? So this year, very, very recently, they have said that what they want to do is bring back the Tasmanian tiger. Now, how are they going to do this? Well, we've got some serious science to explain how they plan on doing this. What they need is a living cell, okay? If you're going to bring something back, you need a living cell. Trouble is they don't have a living cell, surprise, surprise, because these things are all dead. So what they need to do is then find the nearest living relative, essentially. So the animal species, whatever, who is closest, absolutely closest genetically to the Tasmanian tiger. And that is a thing called the fat-tailed dunnet. Okay, dunnet.
Not quite as fearsome a name, is it?
The fat-tailed dunnet. Yeah. It sounds like a sort of
very awkward.
Something you could call somebody, really. And so this has got DNA that is sort of close, I guess, to the Tasmanian tiger. So it's its nearest living relative. And then what they're going to do with this is basically to alter the DNA in a cell of the fat-tailed dunnet to that of the Tasmanian tiger. So the way that they do that is that they have DNA from the Tasmanian tiger. They have DNA samples, so they can sequence that, so they can get its genome. They know the genome, obviously, of this fat-tailed dunnet, and so they basically match them up. So they do all this fancy gene editing stuff. They take the DNA of this little marsupial, this fat-tailed dunnet thing, and basically they make it match the Tasmanian tiger, which just is utterly, utterly mind-boggling that they can do this. And then once they get this living cell, then they use stem cell technology and sort of IVF-type reproductive science. And what they can then do is basically get a foster parent for this. So, and the correct foster parent for this is going to be this fat-tailed dunnet, which is a lot smaller than a Tasmanian tiger. Really, really quite tiny. But the beauty of this is, apparently, ever seen a baby kangaroo? Like a baby kangaroo?
Not in person.
I think I've seen pictures.
Yeah, yes. Like they're about yay size. And I'm holding up my fingers here about a couple of centimetres apart, folks. Yeah. So
an inch tall.
Tiny. An inch? No, 2 centimetres. 2.54 centimetres. We don't use inches. that'll set me off. So they are absolutely tiny. And indeed, they develop mostly in the pouch. Okay, so the fact that... This fat-tailed dunnet is a lot smaller than the Tasmanian tiger, needn't be a problem because of the fact that, you know, it's very, very, very small, and so therefore it can do its development in the pouch of this thing. So that is the plan, and they are thinking that what's going to happen is that they are going to return, if this is successful, they're going to return the Tasmanian tiger to basically an unchanged ecosystem. So, you know, Tasmania, most of Tasmania is pretty wild, and it won't have changed a hell of a lot since the 1930s when they went extinct. So,
unless our second story has something to say about that.
Yeah. So that's the plan anyway. As I say, I don't know how I feel about this. I mean, this is getting into the sort of the Dr. Frankenstein sort of side of things. Now, what happens if something goes wrong, if they don't quite get that DNA match up and everything? I don't know. I mean, it'd be extraordinary science if they managed to pull this off. You know, absolutely amazing.
Has this been done before?
Not to my knowledge. No, I don't think so. I think apparently they are on track with their woolly mammoth. Apparently.
I was going to say, with the woolly mammoth, wasn't that done by taking a frozen...
Yes.
So it was embedded in a sheet of ice or something, and they kind of extracted that, and then were able to get the DNA.
All they need is the DNA. If they can get the DNA sequence, then again they go to the closest living relative, which in that case is the elephant. And that gestation period is like about, elephants like 15, 18 months, something like that. So it's going to take a lot longer for that, rather than this Tasmanian tiger, which could be just sort of a few weeks. So
are Tasmanians concerned about this being brought back for? Because you're saying they affected livestock.
Who's going to ask them? You know,
consultation.
That is a very, very good question, actually.
Because surely the same concerns may arise again, or
you would imagine, unless they put them in a secluded area or something, or a fenced off area. What you know. I don't know.
Not only growing up in an enclosure, but your entire species exists.
Yeah. See, ethical issues abound on this one, don't they? Uh-huh. Yeah.
That's right.
So, I don't know. As I say, I'm really in two minds about this. It would be extraordinary science, but we'll see how it goes. I mean, it could fail dismally,
as it's never been done before.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah.
Could be lots of bumps along the way.
Oh, very many, I would imagine. Yeah, I don't think this is going to be the easiest thing in the world.
Do we have any less scary news?
Less scary news? Oh, no, actually, no, we do, but not this time. So our second story today, right, so how's this for a clickbait title? All rainwater is unsafe to drink, according to study, !
Acid rain?
No, ooh. Not acid rain, no. It's to do with PFAS. PFAS, polyfluorinated alkyl substances, okay? Polyfluorinated or perfluorinated.
That flew off your tongue so nicely.
We chemists, we're used to sort of big words in chemistry, so. Okay, so what's this all about? So, let's go back to 1938, and a guy by the name of Roy Plunkett, who was working in the lab one day with a cylinder of something called tetrafluoroethylene. And that's a gas, and he'd got 90 grams of the gas out of the cylinder. It should have held 100, and so he wondered what was going on. Where was that other 10 grams of his important gas? So, being a scientist, he decided to saw the cylinder in half, find out what had happened. He found this white substance in there, and that was... No? Anybody? No.
Surprise us.
Teflon. Okay, so that was the discovery of Teflon.
We're all exchanging glances.
Knowing looks here in the studio. So that was the accidental discovery of Teflon. Now, Teflon is brilliant, isn't it? We all know that it's fantastic. You want nonstick, you use Teflon. And not just Teflon itself, but a whole lot of other compounds that are similar to Teflon. And the thing that Teflon has got is fluorine in great abundance. Okay, and technically what these compounds are, they are what we call hydrocarbons, things that are made of carbon and hydrogen only, pretty much, except you replace all of the hydrogens with fluorines, and that gives you your non-stick capabilities of Teflon and all of these polyfluorinated things. So they're used in all sorts of everything these days, packaging and makeups and shampoos and, you know, all of these sorts of things. So obviously it finds its way into the environment, and there are concerns over the safety of these materials. So these workers who come from Stockholm and ETH in Zurich and the Czech Republic have done a study mostly of other people's work, a couple of their own, and they're looking at rainwater all around the world, basically. So from places as diverse as China, Sweden, Malta, Portugal, US, and Antarctica. And so they're analysing these rain samples for the presence of these PFAS, these polyfluorinated aliphatic substances. And they found that, yes, they were present in all rain samples collected, or pretty much anyway. Some they think are below the detection limits. And so that's what they're saying. All rainwater is unsafe to drink, according to study, okay? Now, I think a better rewording of that would be some rainwater in China, Sweden, Malta, Portugal, the US, and Antarctica is unsafe to drink. I think they are drawing an extraordinarily long bow here in saying that that all rainwater is unsafe to drink.
Do you know what method they use to decide which areas to take the samples from?
No, I don't. They just seem to be sort of a fairly random area. The majority of them were certainly in China. And I think the studies that they're sort of placing the greatest weight on was one was in the Tibetan Plateau and the other was in Antarctica. So they're basically saying, by extrapolation, if they can get there, then they can get anywhere. Which, you know, it may or may not be the case, but I really don't think that they can go and say that this is the case. And this paper has got huge publicity right around the world. It's a very, very, very... You look at the number of views of this paper, it's in the hundreds of thousands. So, you know, it's obviously gained great traction and stuff. And I think it's just a little bit... maybe disingenuous would be a good word, possibly. So the lead author says, there is nowhere on Earth where the rain would be safe to drink according to the measurements we have taken, which is also disingenuous because they only took two of the set of 14 measurements. So I think that's...
It's possible the methodology could have varied to some degree.
Yeah. So, look, it's a bad thing we've got these things in our rainwater. Now, the reason that this apparently has become a problem where it wasn't before is because they've lowered the safe limits. So all of a sudden, all of these levels that were previously safe are now not safe. Mm. And again, how do you find out what a safe limit is? I think that's a very, very difficult thing to do. You know, you're just on either side of a safe limit. Is it safe? Is it not safe? Anyway, so I don't know about this. So the levels that they're talking are less than nanograms per litre, which probably doesn't mean a heck of a lot to you. But if I say that's sort of the equivalent of a gram, so, you know, roughly what a gram is, in an Olympic-sized swimming pool, roughly, there or thereabouts, okay? So we're talking very, very small amounts, okay? Ideally, it'd be great if they weren't there at all. Sadly, they are. But our third story, and it's funny they came out essentially in the same week, surely we can get rid of these things. And now the trouble with PFAS, these compounds that are collectively known as PFAS, is that they are so damn unreactive that they just stay in the environment. They're not biodegraded.
And is it these that are often called forever chemicals?
Forever chemicals, absolutely. And that's the reason why they're called forever chemicals. So they're sort of impervious to high temperatures. They're impervious to friction. You can't sort of grind them up and destroy them and stuff like that.
They can climb mountains.
Oh, yeah, go to the deepest seas. And yeah, absolutely. But so there's obviously an awful lot of work going on to see if you could possibly remediate these sorts of things. You know, how can you destroy them, ideally? And it seems that a group of folk at Northwestern University in Chicago have found the answer to this, and it's quite simple. It's using a solvent which will be familiar to any chemists listening, which is a thing called DMSO, or to give it its real name, dimethyl sulfoxide, which you may or may not have heard of. But if you're a chemist, you'll certainly know it. And basically, you boil these things up in dimethyl sulfoxide, and you throw in a little bit of sodium hydroxide just to help it along. And that's really, really easy. So you don't have to go to potentially great expense. You don't need sort of fancy reagents in order to do this. This is just bog standard stuff that you can just buy, hell, probably from a chemist almost. And so this seems to be a very, very great advance in getting rid of these chemicals and turning these polyfluorinated chemicals back into fluoride, okay?
So what happens to the original chemicals? Do they go away? Are they, like, separated from the
substance? Well, they turn back into hydrocarbons, essentially. So where the fluorines had replaced the hydrogens, now you're getting hydrogens replacing the fluorines, and it turns back into just sort of various sort of organic chemicals that we can then cope with, that we can get rid of or whatever. But the important thing is that you're breaking all of those carbon-fluorine bonds. Those are the things. Those are the really, really difficult things to break, and they found that this is very, very easily done. So that's a piece of good news here on Dear Science. And, you know, sort of given the second story, I think it's quite appropriate that we have the third story and how to get rid of these nasties.
Give your rainwater a good scrub before you drink.
Yeah, I wouldn't go drinking DMSO, though. It's not the best for you. So, yeah, yeah. So, there we go.
Oh, fantastic. Thanks so much, as always. Really appreciate your interesting stories. And I love that you give solutions.
Yeah.
You know, a lot of science can be really scary.
And remember, next week, folks, the big announcement.
Big announcement.
Oh, boy, it's big. It is huge.
So tune in next week, Dear Science.
Well, I didn't know that before. Dear Science. Thanks to MOTAT, the museum inspiring the innovators of tomorrow.